This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Back in the early 2000s, the Enron scandal became one of the most notorious cases of corporate crime. Top executives at the energy company were tried and sent to prison on multiple counts of fraud. Now, after Enron, you would think big business would be held more accountable. But corporate crime continued. It happened with General Motors, the BP oil spill, the 2008 financial crisis. It goes on. My guest today is one of the lead prosecutors in the Enron case. His new book examines why it's hard to prosecute corporate crime. It's called Capital Offenses, Business Crime and Punishment in America's Corporate Age. Sam Buell is a law professor at Duke, and he joins me now in the studio. Welcome back, Sam.
Thanks, Frank.
You say you were one of the lead prosecutors in the Enron case, and there again was a case of, in some cases, corporate fraud. I mean, obviously, there were people doing things that were illegal. Why was it possible to get a conviction there when others complain, you know, similar crimes are being committed and we can't get the conviction? What was it about that case?
Well, Enron was a case of accounting fraud, and the rules are pretty specific about how you have to report corporate earnings. And we had a period in the late 90s and early 2000s when a number of companies started to play games with those rules. Enron wasn't the only company that got caught. The famous WorldCom bankruptcy with Bernard Ebers, the Adelphia case. There were a whole series of these cases where envelope pushing became breaking the envelope. And Enron, you know, one thing led to another and the company collapsed. And so when a company that big collapses, which was a shocking event, you're going to have an autopsy. You're going to have a legal autopsy, a very detailed legal autopsy. And we found quite a few instances where Enron had gone over the lines. And these were provable, technical, but very large and important violations of the accounting rules. So in that sense, there was provable crime there. Lots of what happened at Enron was actually perfectly legal. But also very aggressive and involved bad risk taking. And the fact that the company evaporated and went bankrupt was probably as much attributable to the stupid legal things that they did as opposed to the clever illegal things that they did.
Right. So they could have possibly obscured some of what they did and got away with it at least a little bit longer.
Absolutely. Yep. And some of that had to do with the bursting of the tech bubble, by the way. People forget that bubbles burst, and often that's what leads to more scrutiny of companies. And this was around the time when technology stocks started to plummet a little bit and the stock market was going down. So that kind of exposed a little bit of what Enron was doing that otherwise might not have been noticed.
And this is, I think, the interesting point. And the part of the point of your book is that while people are screaming for blood, why was no one sent to jail in the aftermath of 2008? Well, because most of what they did was legal. And in 2008, we look back at the Enron case, there were very specific changes in securities regulation designed particularly for them through the Bush administration that allowed them to hide some of what they were doing and keep it from accountants, right?
Well, it's even worse than that, Frank. I mean, in the sense that if you look carefully at the forensic autopsy that was done on Enron and you look at some of the forensic autopsies that were done on the big banks, including, for example, Lehman Brothers, there's some really uncanny similarities in some of the structured finance. In Enron's case, they were basically propping up their stock price on their own stock price. They figured out a way to use their stock as collateral to make their company seem like it was worth more than it was. And that made the stock go up. And so then the stock collateral was worth more and so on, until, of course, the directional arrow turns the other way. Well, what the banks were doing with housing prices was actually quite similar. The securitization of mortgages, off-balance sheet entities. A lot of the things that the banks did leading up to the financial crisis were things that we could have figured out from Enron needed stricter regulation, and we didn't.
Right. And again, I think part of this, too, points to the complexity in, first of all, diagnosing and then curing some of this problem. Along the way, there have to be other agencies, entities, financial institutions that understand what's going on here and are in too deep to actually blow the whistle. I mean, isn't that part of it? I see what you're doing here, but I'm in this, too.
Or they're simply overwhelmed. One of the things that I talk about in the book is the problem of loopholing and how the law and regulatory institutions are always going to, in some sense, be one step behind industry, because industry's in the business of actually designing its behavior around the legal regimes that exist. So the behaviors will always be one step ahead of those legal regimes. And a lot was talked about at the time of Enron about how the SEC was kind of overwhelmed by the size of the task that they had. And it was just really over their heads to figure out Enron's finances. And of course, we had similar stories about the SEC around the financial crisis, most famously the fact that they Madoff was sitting right under their noses and they didn't catch it. So there's a mismatch there in sophistication and resources and technology.
But that's the cops and robbers game, which is an important part of your book and the question that we would ask ourselves in public policy. But then the vaunted let the market decide question is also, I think, raises some questions here. Why don't financial institutions recognize what they're doing? Why don't investment advisors understand that they're using their own stock to prop up the price of their stock? The market should have caught this too, right?
Yeah, and just like we talk about in policing, we talk about preventing crime and then we talk about prosecuting crime. We should be thinking about corporate crime the same way, right? Simply prosecuting wrongdoers mm-hmm. after the fact is not necessarily going to prevent crime, just like with respect to street crime. Look at what we've discovered in this country over the last 20 or 30 years. We had the biggest binge in imprisonment in human history with respect to street crime. And some people think that that does explain part of why crime rates have gone down, but it's complicated. And nonetheless, we're left with this additional huge problem, which is incarceration in the United States, which we now is a separate problem that we now have to fix. So, just like we've started to say in street crime, well, maybe there's some things that we could be focusing policing on that's more of a preventive nature. So, too, we ought to be having that conversation in the corporate crime context.
And that puts a finger on something else that you stress in the book, and that is, again, the way we've structured our policing. And I think the best example of this is an example that you give right in the introduction of your book in the ways in which the criminal justice system is in some ways skewed to find individuals and finds it very difficult to prosecute corporate crime. Can you give us that
example? Right. So the book starts with the story of Candace Anderson, who was one of the people who was actually a victim. She was treated as a criminal, but she turned out to be a victim in the GM starter switch, ignition switch scandal. So Candace Anderson was prosecuted for vehicular manslaughter because her car crashed in Texas outside Dallas one day, and her fiancé was killed in that crash. He was sitting next to her in the passenger seat. She had a little bit of Xanax in her system when they did a blood test, and they decided that it was an intoxication case, which was actually incorrect. But they prosecuted her, and she thought she had done something wrong and that she was caught. She pled guilty, and she was punished. She didn't go to prison, but she was placed on probation. She had to do hundreds of hours of community service, and she was branded a felon in the death of her own fiancé. Well, it turned out 10 years later, it was discovered when all this stuff came out about the problem in the Saturn Ion and the Chevy Cobalt starter switch, that it was the car's fault. And the fault of the company that made the car, not Candace. The car malfunctioned, the airbags didn't deploy, the power steering didn't work, the power brakes didn't work, and that was what caused the crash. Her conviction was expunged. The legal system in Texas said, we made a mistake, you're not a criminal. And then the question becomes, okay, who is the criminal? Now what do? Can we put GM in prison for this? No, because you can't put a corporation in prison. And even the process of figuring out at GM who was involved in the bad starter switch, who actually knew at the level of management that there was a problem. In fact, almost nobody knew. It was a problem that was created by a low-level engineer. When he discovered his mistake, he kind of covered it up, not because he thought he'd committed a crime, but because he just didn't want to get in trouble at work. And it becomes a very difficult and very different process to attribute criminal responsibility when we decide, oh, wait a minute, it's the company that manufactured the car, not the person who was driving it.
So within the organization, complex organization, very big, hard to figure out which individual will prosecute in the way that Candace could easily be tested. And, as Xanax, by the way, not a substance that can cause intoxication by law. So that was wrong to begin with. But anyway, we can do that. We can test her. We can send her to jail. Can't send a corporation to jail. But you can do the equivalent, right? I mean, the theory of punishment is if one is threatened with the loss of their freedom, one might think twice about committing this act. So suspend the activities. The corporation is in jail. GM no longer exists for 10 years.
Well, but of course, wait a minute, Frank, because, what's good for GM is good for America, right? Uh-huh. And, think about the 2012 election. A lot of people said that Obama wouldn't have been reelected if he hadn't succeeded in bailing out the car companies and all of that, what that meant for the industrial Midwest and those swing states, Michigan, Ohio. I'm not just being politically cynical about this. I mean, It's a serious matter. Tens of thousands of jobs. Our economy is incredibly dependent on these large manufacturing corporations, more so all the time as we fret that they're going offshore and we've got fewer and fewer of these precious jobs left. So you can't put GM out of business as a punishment. You just can't. It's a practical matter.
Which is to say we're all complicit in this. While we're looking for a few bad apples, the fact is it's systemic, and the extent to which we believe that we can't do without these corporations is the extent to which they will continue to practice this way.
And so then a lot of people would fall back on the argument that, okay, well, I get your point, but what about the managers? Let's put those top managers in prison, and then we can get new managers who will then be afraid of going to prison and they'll do a better job. Well, the trouble with that is we have some very basic principles in this country about what it takes to be sent to prison for a crime. You have to have done something wrong, and you've had to have more or less known that what you were doing was wrong. And that becomes extremely difficult to prove, not just because it's hard to get the evidence, but because that may not have happened. It's very hard to prove with respect to high-level managers in big corporations, because the nature of the big company is that it is set up for the purpose of dividing labor and dividing responsibility. And so it becomes very difficult to prove that a vice president or a president in GM knew anything about the starter switch that was in Candace's car at the time that accident occurred.
Yeah, but let's take, again, this look of the theory of punishment. We don't say because you're drunk and not quite in your right mind, you're not responsible for your actions. So the individual is responsible for their action. Again, a corporation, very complicated. The engineer messed up. The CEO didn't know. But if I was to send the CEO to jail, CEO is going to know. Doesn't this place that extra responsibility on the CEO to say, I better be darn sure that every car that comes off the line is safe because I'm going to jail if it's not?
Well, in theory, I agree with you. But think about the scale of General Motors. I mean, this is an entity that is almost too large to, just like the big banks leading up to the financial crisis. I mean, it is unrealistic for us to expect that a human or a small group of humans are really going to be in a position to be able to handle these companies, to be able to know enough about what's going on to have that level of personal responsibility. It really is, you know, the too big to fail has a corollary of too big to manage. And that's one of the things that I worry about a lot in this book, and I talk about at the end, is maybe we really need to start talking about how we get the scale of this problem back down to some kind of a human scale. And that's not the purpose of the book. The book is to talk about corporate crime, but it ends with the thought, maybe the next conversation we need to be having is a conversation like the conversation that we had over 100 years ago when we first got antitrust law and we started thinking about the problem of scale in corporations and the level of dominance of corporations in the economy. How do we bring that back to earth?
That conversation would be complicated by the very scale that you talk about, because it also gives those corporations a lot of money and a lot of political clout. And you write about that in your book, too. The fine line between bribery and politics as usual.
Yeah. And I worry that, you know, a lot of people think, well, you know, corporations have Washington captured, and that's true of criminal justice as well. Well, I'm not so sure about that. I mean, I worry sometimes that the conversation about criminal justice is displacing the conversation about regulation in a way that, if you were really wanted to be cynical about it, you would say is to the corporation's benefit. I mean, they'd rather have, the periodic outrage about a few bad apples than the kind of very expensive, comprehensive regulatory reform that we need to prevent a next Enron or a next financial crisis. And, you know, some evidence for that is that if you look, you know, in contrast to the story about regulation in various industries over the last 20, 30 years, if you look over those last several decades, you're hard-pressed to find a single example where the corporate lobby has succeeded in cutting back on criminal law in the federal code, where they've succeeded in cutting back on the ability of federal prosecutors legally, aside from what resources they have, but the laws that they have, to prosecute white-collar crime and prosecute corporations. And that could be because that's not really the fight the corporations want to have.
But they spent a lot of money and have been successful in keeping taking regulations off the book. I mean, Glass-Steagall is gone, and that was the thing. It worked so well that everybody thought, well, we don't need it anymore. No, it's why you haven't had the collapse you have. And so they were successful in that, keeping other regulations from being written and actually taking regulation off the book. That's important.
But which would you rather live with if you were a very large bank? Glass-Steagall or a few occasional prosecutions? Well, of course, a few occasional prosecutions.
Right. But that's my point. Their money is effective in reducing regulation that
absolutely
leads to these collapses over and over again. And also in just being able to defend themselves. They've got lots of money and keep these cases going on forever. Ultimately, the government cries uncle and says, let's settle.
Well, and it's, again, yes, they do have an advantage in resources when it comes to criminal cases against corporations. But as we spoke about with GM, you know, this was also an issue with the banks, particularly in the area, in the era just after the financial crisis. You know, were you really going to prosecute? Were you going to spend $1 trillion to bail out the financial system? Because we realized we could not live without these banks, despite all the horrible things they did. They were making the economy run. Credit would freeze up without these banks. So we spent $1 trillion to bail them out. Were you really going to turn around the very next day and say, oh, but now we're going to prosecute one of them and put them out of business? I mean, there's a kind of illogic in that. And I point up that contradiction in the book to say we haven't quite reckoned with the extent to which we are all heavily dependent on these big, massive corporate institutions. And again, it may be that the scale is the biggest problem of all, and we need to think about how to break that down.
But again, you would expect a certain amount of resistance to that, wouldn't you? Even if you proposed that, it's precisely the scale that would mount the obstacle to any conversation about that.
Absolutely. One of the things I say in the book is that I push back quite a bit in this book on the idea that the sort of no bankers in jail narrative is the way to get things moving forward. You know, I push back on that and say that actually that may be a diversion or a counterproductive discussion. And then I say that the folks who've been saying that actually haven't been being ambitious enough. That it may be a deeper kind of change that we really ought to be talking about.
If we focus on the bad apples, it becomes an individual problem. We lose sight of the structure.
Yeah, and the fight that we have to have is a tougher fight. It's not a fight just to, you know, get a prosecutor to bring a few more indictments.
Sam Buell, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Great to be here, Frank. Thank you.
Sam Buell is a Duke Law professor and author of the new book called Capital Offenses, Business, Crime, and Punishment in America's Corporate Age. And we've got more information about the book at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton-Normand, and Katie Barron. Robin Copley's our technical director. Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.